It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
Crazy kids. That's us.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Laurie.
Good morning,
hey,
Heavy.
Ezzy.
How is our crazy host today?
crazy. But you know, it's all the stuff that goes on around the world. I mean, it's impossible to keep it all together. And we were just
sure
talking
enough
a moment ago about potential mergers in the automotive industry. You know, like, are there going to be new cars to have to remember now? There's so many coming out of China now. I don't know what's up or down.
Hey, the other thing Lori brought up this morning, and there's two or three things. One, Amazon's talking about delivering all their packages under 4 pounds via drones. How about that?
And have government approval to do this. They expect to start in 6 months.
In China, tell them about
really?
China, honey.
What about
China's developed
a
train.
They've developed, they're working on, and they plan to introduce it, I suppose, in the very near future, an extraordinarily fast train. I don't have it in front of me. It's going to go at over 350 miles an hour.
And it floats on the
amazing,
track.
Which is interesting, because the French and the Germans were going to actually bring their two major companies together, and the European Union said absolutely not. And the French and the Germans said, well, that means you're going to leave it wide open for the Chinese, and evidently they're here. That's the end of that.
You know, we were just using the phrase before we came on live, Hezzy, that there are so many balls to juggle now in any kind of a large decision, whether it's a corporate acquisition situation like we're seeing with Renault and Fiat Chrysler and the ups and downs of that scenario, or any of these matters where governments, you know, have a play and a say in what happens, what the outcome is of some of these massive decisions, that it's almost, as you say, it's too much to comprehend.
Yeah.
Well, I want to go back to the Chinese.
Of it, Lori.
I want to go back to the Chinese thing, this idea that they can develop a train and it floats on the tracks, or that kind of thing.
It floats over the tracks.
Floats over the tracks. And do you remember, and I've said this before in one of our shows or more than one, but remember the old Dick Tracy cartoon, and it had the vehicles, and they had the solar things?
Right.
And the statement was, the man who rules the sun rules the world, or the man who harnesses the sun rules the world.
Right.
And this idea, more and more, because we were talking about the drone thing. I'm getting a lot of feedback from somewhere, but the drone thing we were talking about, well, they're delivering packages under 4 pounds. Well, how long is it before they have drones that a person can
50 pounds
occupy and manipulate and fly in? And then once you have that, your necessity of having vehicle cars like we know them today will become more and more obsolete. I mean, it is the future. We're looking literally, looking at the future. And I'm sure I told you that when I taught school, I told my kids that in their lifetime, they would have cars that would drive themselves. Look how close we are to that.
Exactly. One last thing before we go into cars. You know, the elevated trains that are, what are they, riding on a cushion of air, like in an upside-down T? And then so there's like a middle rung, and then the train is just able to fly over it, and there's no resistance because it's other than air resistance.
Right.
It's almost like a kind of hovercraft concept, I suppose.
Yeah.
But, you know, we think about these things, and to Johnny's point just now, I mean, imagine a world where people have big, huge television screens that they can have interactive communication with people, you know, all around them, that books are obsolete. I mean, this was, and that and that the government controls everything the people hear, or the press controls everything the people hear and see. This was 1953. Ray Bradbury's concept with his brilliant book,
Absolutely.
Fahrenheit 451. When we first saw
Absolutely.
That movie, when that came, when we read the book, when the movie came out with Julie Christie and Oscar Werner, when in 1960, we thought that time would never happen. But it's exactly what
right.
we're living through today.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible.
True.
So these things, it's a bit of a digression from what we're going to talk about today, but it, you know, so
it's important. It's a part of life type things that people, I think, ought to at least be aware of, and then they can pursue it themselves. But it has to do with transportation, movement, buying what you're buying, looking ahead to the future,
mm-hmm.
what are you planning? I think it has to do with all that.
Now, to the point on the Chinese train, let's just say that that train ends up becoming really a real reality, and it's totally dependable, and people aren't, you know, the accident rate is very low, if
right.
non-existent, whatever. The point is that at that speed, that train, by the time you even factor, whether or not you factor in the time it takes you get to the station, et cetera, that's going to supersede air travel. Air travel will suffer.
Absolutely.
If
Correct.
We end up having ground transportation that could manage to do that. And I guarantee you in 20 years, Johnny's going to look at me and say, oh, the drones arrived with our 400-pound package. Remember when we thought 4 pounds was never going to happen? You know?
Whatever
exactly.
your name is, remember that those days?
Yeah. We never owned a Buick.
Yeah,
so
right.
to that point, we're taking a bit of a different twist on our car talking today. And normally when we review cars, we talk about who's going to buy this car. How was this car designed? Who was the person or the family or the lifestyle that the car designers had in mind when they designed that car? So we're putting a little bit of a twist on it today. And instead we're talking about, all right, you, individual person, have X numbers of dollars, X number of dollars. You have X number of people in your family. Here's your lifestyle. Here are your needs. Now, you're going out into the marketplace to figure out what suits you best. And the problem that we hear all the time is people will come to us and say, well, what car do you recommend? We either know them or they'll tell us, you know, who they are and what their life is like. What car do you recommend? And the problem is there's so much that's offered. I mean, Henry Ford would never have dreamt. This is like Fahrenheit 451. He would have never have dreamt that there were so many manufacturers and that each manufacturer had so many different models and each model had so many different sub-models to offer. I mean,
mm-hmm.
and I think that in a nutshell, without going into it, this is why we're seeing so much competition and so much difficulty maintaining our car manufacturers to the, you know, the elevated financial heights that they need to be maintained at because there are too many choices. So Johnny and I picked two vehicles that we thought we would talk about that we felt appealed to the same individual in the same price point, and that is the 2019 Lexus NX 300 SUV and the Mazda 2019 CX-9. So first we're going to talk a little bit about each car, and then we're going to go into this mode about, all right, you can afford either of these cars. Both of these cars suit your lifestyle and your needs, and how do you make a decision? So, Johnny, do you want to start?
No.
All right. Let's.
You ask.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start. I'll tell you what. Johnny, you take the Lexus. I'll take the Mazda. The Mazda, these cars are very similar. They look so much alike in appearance. There certainly are differences. We'll go into those.
Well, and one of the things that it was cool was they were both the ones we got were white.
Oh, that's right, they were.
Yeah, the Lexus is eminent white, and the Mazda was snowflake white. So.
And Hezzy,
well,
I dare
difference.
You to tell me the difference. You know, again, I'm sorry I keep digressing, but this reminds me of that fabulous movie, Mr. Blandings Builds his Dream House with Myrna Loy and Cary Grant. And they finally buy this dilapidated farmhouse in Connecticut, thinking it's going to be their ideal commuter home, which, of course, they find out from the train schedule that he's going to have to get up at 4 in the morning in order to get to work. But they buy this dilapidated farmhouse that has great history, and it literally falls apart, so they have to start from scratch and build. So they build this gorgeous house, the house of their dreams. It ends up being three times more than their budget had originally allowed. And so Myrna Loy, the housewife, the wife, has the painter and his assistant trailing her as she walks through each room of the house to say which color she wanted each room. Now, these are local painters. This is when Connecticut really did have, you know, farmers and kind of, you know, non-city type people. And so she goes into one room and she says, I want this to be green, not like a ripe apple green that you would see in, you know, such as in the Granny Smith apple, but more of a spring green. And so each room she says, blue, not like a bluebird's wing, but a little softer blue, you know, yellow. And so anyway, so she walks out of the room and each one, and then she has a thread. She has a thread and she goes, soft yellow, not like the thread. And she gives them the thread, quite, very close to the strip, but more like a canary yellow. It goes on and on, and it's hysterical. So she leaves the room because her husband summons her. And so the painter, the contractor, looks at his assistant who's taking notes, and he said, did you get that? Green, yellow, blue, and white. so my point is we have these two cars that are, what are the cars? Snowflake white and eminent white.
Yeah. It's Snowflake White Pearl and Eminent White. Eminent, E-M-I-N-E-N-T, Eminent White.
And so no matter how you slice it, it's white. I mean,
yeah.
But that's, so I'm going to go ahead with the Mazda. The Mazda was a sensational vehicle. Just absolutely knocked my socks off. It's a seven.
I went around sockless for like days on end.
Days on end.
Incredible.
Just couldn't even put my socks on. And it was a seven-seater, seven people, two in the front, three in the middle, two in the back.
Go, Steve, hold on.
Okay, God bless you. And beautiful, beautiful detail. God bless you, darling. The interior, the leather upholstery, the size, the shape, the comfort of the seats, you'd have to really push me to find anything that I objected to with this vehicle. It was fabulous. And Mazda's just not a brand that comes, you know, screaming to the front of my mind when I say, what's my favorite, you know, manufacturing company? I don't. Everybody's almost, you know, as Bugsy Lawler said to us not that long ago, there's no such thing as a bad car being made anymore. All cars are just, I mean, there really isn't. So this Mazda CX-9, it seats seven people. The interior seating is wonderful, comfortable, voluptuous. The car has easy manipulation on the road, easy to drive, soundless inside, no noise whatsoever. I mean, just, and it's got all the bells and whistles, which Johnny, you know, I'm going to have you talk about this in a minute, but and sleek. And beautifully designed, the wraparound exterior lights, front and rear. Now, what I just told you is identical to what I would say about the Lexus NX300, with the exception that the Lexus is a five-seater car. So this
and the
is
price
how
point
close.
Is similar?
Exactly. And in fact, I'll go over the similarities after we go over a description of the cars, because it's mind-boggling. Same price point, same miles per gallon. I mean, we'll talk about this in a second. We chose these two cars because they have more in common than they have not in common, and the very few things that they do not have in common are minor things, with the exception that the Lexus has seating capacity of five, the Mazda has seating capacity of seven. But everything that I
so
would
mean,
say about the Mazda,
me,
I would say about the Lexus.
So you mean to tell me if I, you know, I could be in the market for the Lexus, but if I'm expecting to have two more children, it's over for me?
Yeah, unless you strap them to the roof or have a family like our son.
Okay.
Yeah, that's going to be
a car great for
Wynn.
Right? This is a car.
Wynn is going to have to buy a fleet. Yeah, he's going to have to start towing a car behind a car in order to accommodate all of his kids. Luckily, he's not here to say something about it. But anyway, Johnny, what did you think about the Mazda?
Although you said that we weren't necessarily going to be comparing them, and we will be doing some of that kind of thing. But we also talk about a lot about brand and brand loyalty, and you said, I don't think of Mazda as a certain type of thing. Well, do you remember Mazda's entry into the car world? And it was that they had a rotary engine. Do you remember that?
Yes.
I was a child.
I remember.
Yeah, well, Tezzy would remember.
Well, you were
that
a child,
was a big deal.
But I'm older than that.
Me too. But you remember that? That was a big deal. The rotary engine. And,
absolutely.
You know, did it hold up? And all, there was lots of commercials about it. And finally, because it was never really accepted, it went away.
Yeah, but
and
it's coming back.
To,
I hear it's coming back now.
Well, that would be the time, I think.
Continued their development. Yeah.
Okay. And people are probably more receptive to those kinds of things now. But when it did come out, it was not well received. It wasn't.
No.
And I think there's this, when you hear the word Mazda, for me anyway, that's the first thing that comes into my mind. I know it's all different now. I understand that.
Right.
I understand they make a quality car. But the first thing that comes in my mind is Mazda made the rotary engine. It was like a three-cylinder or something, the rotary engine.
Mm-hmm.
And then, now, okay, keep that in your mind, and I'll mention the word Lexus. What comes into your mind when you hear the word Lexus? Lexus was built around the whole idea that this was a, help me here, what kind of car?
Luxury car.
And so, so their premise was, we're going to offer you a luxury product. So the first thing from a consumer standpoint that comes into my mind, if I'm comparing a Mazda to a Lexus, is, well, the Mazda is more of an everyday utilitarian vehicle, and the Lexus is a luxury vehicle. It may or may not be true, but I'm just telling you that from a consumer standpoint, those are the things that I think enter into people's minds.
And yet, we had the Mazda CX-9. Let's see, what was the model? Got to look it up. But the fact of
it's a CX-9.
The signature.
All-wheel drive signature.
The signature.
Top of the line.
Top of the line. And I
all-wheel drive.
I challenge you to tell me where there's not a zillion percent luxury in that vehicle. It luxurious.
I'm in violent agreement with you. No, I
agree.
Thing.
I agree with you. You know what the difference is? The difference is that the Mazda model has a certain definition of itself, because there's similarities between the models, the look. And when you look at the Lexus, it's different, it's unique. You can actually recognize it, especially from the front end. And so you see that it's a Lexus. You know, you can see it coming. And you don't always see that with a Mazda, because it's too much like other vehicles. You know what I'm saying?
But these two particular models looked so close, Hezzy. They looked so
I
similar.
I looked at them. Absolutely.
Now here's one thing. This I love this. Okay, the Mazda has 227 horsepower. And the Lexus has 235 horsepower. I dare anybody on the planet to say to me, oh, God, could you feel the difference in horsepower between those two vehicles? No, you can't. It's not possible.
No.
I also want to cover something, and I don't think you said this on the air. You might have, but we were talking about some things before we went on the air, and that was that there's in any particular manufacturer, there are many models. And then within the models, there are divisions of that model. And the Mazda CX crossover and SUV, the CX has a CX-3, a CX-5, and a CX-9. So the CX series starts at $20,390. Not very expensive.
Right.
The CX-9 starts at $32,280. The one that we got was $45,000 to start with, because it was within the CX-9, there are different subsets. And one of them, the highest end one, is the Signature Series. There's also, I can tell you exactly in just a second, because, there's the Sport in the CX-5, Touring, Grand Touring, and Grand Touring Reserve in the CX-5.
Now, here's the difference.
Well,
in everything except the Signature, you have an option for front-wheel drive or all-wheel drive, and there's going to be a price difference. Front-wheel drive will be less than all-wheel drive. However, the Signature is only offered in all-wheel drive. So that's going to contribute to the higher price for this premium model of that model because of that component in the drivetrain.
Well, the Sport.
Because
okay,
I got a question.
Well,
I got a question. How does the consumer differentiate what they need? Why would they want to consider an all-wheel drive as opposed to just a front-wheel drive?
That's a great question.
Isn't that the problem?
It's part of it, I think.
The confusion?
That they offer all these. The confusion, right.
The confusion.
Yeah.
Well, and the real answer to your question is, what is your normal driving scenario? If you're in a place that has lots of weather, that would be rain, because then the roads get slick, snow, anything like that where you have, I think, those kinds of driving conditions, you probably want all-wheel drive.
If you
live in Arizona, if you live in Arizona where it's dry and most of the time, you don't need four-wheel drive unless you're off-roading, and this is not a vehicle particularly that you would take off-road.
And yet, Johnny, let me intervene. If you live in the north and say, oh, well, we have snow and ice, you can have icy snow conditions, you can have straight ice conditions, and you can have two-wheel drive or rear-wheel drive or four-wheel drive or all-wheel drive or no drive. It doesn't matter. If you're on ice, you're not going to be able to control your car if you get
into
a big spin.
Yeah, but in snow, I think all-wheel drive absolutely is. Absolutely.
And yet we've driven cars with front-wheel drive that are just as roadworthy.
Well, I'm just saying.
And that depends on the weight of the car, too, that kind of factor. And what kind of tires do you have? There are so many factors.
Cars? What, have you been living in North Carolina this long?
Yeah.
You meant tires.
I said tires. What did I say? Tires.
Cars.
Was that...
Oh, tires.
Did I really? I'm
sorry.
You did. Sorry, honey.
It's okay.
And I'm sorry that I was backseat driving the other day, too.
Let's not talk about it.
Again, I can't stand
it. Oh, my gosh,
Debbie. Kind of whenever we go out. Yeah, it's tough. Like
well,
I said, we don't fight about anything else.
John, when you drive alone and Lori's not there, do you have a recording that you play just so that you can feel comfortable knowing that Lori's there, like an autopilot? I would miss her.
You know the answer to that question is no. And you know I enjoy the peace and quiet when I'm driving by myself.
Okay, all right.
I told you the story once about two editors who I took on a ride drive in Volvo, and it was when the navigation system first came out. And Volvo's original navigation system in the cross-country wagon came out of a dashboard. You pressed it down, and then it popped up. It wasn't a fixed fixture at that time. These two editors went off together, and they got lost. They got lost for like 2 hours before they met up with the rest of the crowd. And they said, well, we didn't know what that bump was in the dashboard. And so
you're running out of time. We haven't even talked about the Lexus. It's only 7 minutes left.
When they realized that it was the navigation system, one of the editors wrote in his review of the car, he wrote, I couldn't follow the navigation system even when I figured out what it was and how to work it because he said it would have been so much better if it had my wife's voice instead of the programmed voice, because then if I heard the voice saying, you missed the turn, what's wrong with you? You were supposed to turn two blocks back.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
Don't you have how to drive? He said, if I had had her voice on my navigation system, I would have gotten to wherever I had to go. So.
Let me say a couple more things about the Mazda, and then if we don't get to the Lexus, we'll do it next week or something. But this, one of the things that they list under, because I always look at the safety and security things, one of the things they listed on the safety part of this was what they called Sky Active, what was the last word? Sky Active Body. And I thought, I've never heard of that. So I typed that in. And it is a design of the body of the vehicle to absorb and move energy, which creates a much more protective skin around the drivers. The actual frame is you know, big engineering deal here, because this type of frame allows for much more safety in an accident situation. Plus, they have all the things to keep you out of the accident. But the fact that they would put that in there said, look, we've done a lot of work here, and we want it to be recognized. So that's why I looked it up and thought it was really, I think it's really good. And it has this one, and again, this is sort of like the Lexus. We can talk about it all next week too. But, I mean, the mileage, 26 miles, averages 23 miles to gallon. All the safety features.
But both cars average 28 miles a gallon.
23.
No. 20, we'll double check, but I have 28. Also, both cars have the same number.
No, they don't. No, I'm looking at it. The 23 for the Mazda and 24 for the Lexus. That's what they average.
This may be the first time that we ever argue outside of being in a car.
The it's 20 in the city and 26 on the highway, or 22 in the city and 28 on the highway.
I love you, John. You're so good.
Yeah.
Look at the papers. You're so adorable. You were so. I love the haircut that in your beard trim yesterday from your barber is so gorgeous. You're so gorgeous. And also,
I'm about to get zinged.
And they have the same number of stars for federal government. You know,
a lot of the areas.
Yeah, exactly the same. So anyway, the upshot of it is that maybe this is part one of a 2-part conversation, because we haven't even touched on the Lexus yet.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I do. I think it deserves some equal time. But my
Absolutely.
Point about talking about both of these was, it's the whole conversation was, well, you're going to buy a car. What do you consider? Well, what do you consider? I mean, Hezzy brought it up, and then we talked about the models and the different things and where the starting price is. Is it always about money? I think certainly money is one of the biggest contributors in your purchase.
Well, here's one thing I want to bring up now that we can talk about next week, and that's this. I mean, for example, on the prices, top of the line Mazda $45,500, in the 2020 Lexus for this model $46,000. You're talking about a $500 difference. I have measurements that we'll talk about too next week, but here's the bottom line.
Well, look at these two before you just numbers now.
Okay.
What is the manufacturer's suggested retail price for this Mazda, the one that we drove? What's the price?
This is like a
49.2. I'll tell you what it is.
Yeah, $49,230,000.
And how much is it for the Lexus, the one that we drove?
It was $50,093.
You're talking about $800 difference in the two vehicles.
And now this is the one other point I want to make. And again, I guess this is part one of a 2-part conversation, because we haven't given Lexus the kind of time we need to do. And here's this. This to me is so incredible. The Lexus is touted as having ample, wonderful second seat leg room. The Mazda, which seats 7, is reviewed by other reviewers as having relatively tight legroom in the second seat. Well,
how else do you
accommodate
a third
row?
Yeah.
And the difference is, there is a difference in body length of this car between the two cars. The Mazda is about 16 inches longer. Okay, I'll give you that. But, you know.
Well, the Lexus, it said about the Lexus was that you had plenty of leg room, but you had limited space in the back.
It's
you had to put
storage.
The seat down.
Right.
So what do? Mazda made it longer, so you put the rear seat down, and now you have enormous amount of space.
And you have
the back.
Ample storage with the three rows of seat in the Mazda.
Sure.
So now you're trading off ample leg room for tighter leg room. I mean, this is how you juggle it. So, again, this brings us back, and then we'll stop here, but this brings us back to, you've got your wallet's this big, you've got this much to spend. Your family's the same as anybody. You've got the family is the same, the lifestyle's the same, da da da. Everything's the same. Okay, which car do you choose? Because they are relatively going to give you everything that you need and want, but here are the considerations.
Multiple choice. It's going to be, and I don't care, you know, as a family, you say, hey, we need a new car. What do you think we ought to get? And the conversation starts. Maybe it's a sedan. Well, my gosh, think of all the various sedans that you could choose from all of the manufacturers that are available today.
Mm.
And so where do you start? How do you pick? What do you like? Is it something you're used to? My dad always drove Fords. Hey, my family's always been Chevrolet people. You know, it's just there's so many factors that enter into what it is that you buy. I've always wanted a sports car. Oh, wow. Well, just think how many sports cars there are out there.
And if you had told me,
exactly.
you know, which seven-seat SUV would you choose, I guarantee you my first thought would not be a Mazda until after I drove this one.
And it was beautiful. But you
wow.
know, when you talk about that, we just had a Blazer, which is a brand new, bringing back the old Blazer, the old K5-type Blazer, only it looks brand new. It is brand new. But it's the same thing. There's a seven-passenger vehicle. How many of these can you pick? I guarantee you Ford's got one or two. Chevy's got one or two. Lexus has one or two. I know Mercedes has several, right?
Which brings you into the broader question, and that is, you know, are we being flooded with too many choices?
Yeah.
So that's it for this week. And if you don't mind, Hezzy, I think we'll just continue this conversation next week because
we may add
so
something
to,
next week, but we
yeah,
definitely want to.
There's so much more to say. And you know, for as much as we've touted the Mazda, gosh, that Lexus was a dream. And
yeah.
Fred, although in my estimation, any Lexus is a dream. But, you know, I think that we'll just have to stop right here. What do you say, Hezzy?
Okay. Well, we actually have to go because we've got our next guest. So, but I'm looking forward to Mazda and Lexus next week, part two.
We'll talk to you then.
All
have
the
a
best.
Good week.
Thank you, buddy. Bye.
All
bye
the
bye
best,
now.
Guys. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, let's welcome Judge Lehr. How are you?
Oh, good morning. How are you? Thank you for having me, Hezzy.
Oh, thank you. What a pleasure. It was great meeting you at the Jordanian flag raising about a month ago. That was exciting, and I was
yeah.
a little unsteady in my standing because I'm walking around with a cane now recently, so I hope I didn't press your hand too hard.
Oh, no, not at all.
But what a pleasure meeting you.
Yeah, so nice
well,
to meet you, and that was it was a beautiful day in Yonkers.
It was. Well, you're vying to become the next Westchester County Court Judge. And you've got a compelling history. So, you know, but is there a tremendous amount of political, engagement when it comes to actually becoming a member of the judicial system here in Westchester County? Is it very different than any other place? Or are there similarities or new constraints, particularly to this year?
Well, the new thing this year is that we're having a primary for county court, and so that's giving the voters, all the Democrats in Westchester will now get the opportunity to choose who they would like to be on the ballot as their Democratic nominee. So that's what's
right.
exciting this year for voters. And nationwide, there's a trend for people to run in primaries, as you know. And so it's a great opportunity for democracy to play out and to let the Democratic process provide new candidates and new judges in this case.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's going to be very, very compelling. So this is very, very unique. And does that affect the public very much?
I
or make
it
more confusing?
I think it affects the public because they, you know, they get a chance to be a part of the decision making this time around. And so
mm-hmm.
they need to do their work and research all the candidates and pick the best person for the job. In this case, I think it's me. Coming from a public defender background, I've had almost 20 years of experience in criminal law. And so I bring that with me onto the bench in Peekskill. From a public defender perspective, as opposed to very, very typically you see prosecutors becoming judges. So it's nice for everybody to get the chance to see some more balance on the bench. And I bring that with me. I'm a sitting judge in Peekskill. I'm the first woman ever to be a judge there. So I bring that with me to Peekskill. And I bring it with me further. I'll bring it with me further onto the county court bench as well.
You bring up a very pertinent point, and that is we don't have many women in the courts. And maybe you can explain, because you're probably more proficient at it than I am, because as a woman, don't people recognize that women bring a different perspective that might be just more empathic to issues and situations that a lot of men don't recognize, and that they undermine women's capacity even to fend for themselves outside the courtroom, and the same thing happens in the courtroom as well. So you need that empathy,
right.
Don't
yes.
you?
Yes, you know, you bring up a couple of things. So, you know, as a progressive Democrat, I am obviously pro-choice, and we know that nationally there's a crisis that's going on as far as women's right to choose.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important now more than ever that women are in positions of power, and that includes women judges. I think the statistic now is that we have about 35% of the women in New York State that are judges, and we know that a majority of the women in New York State are – a majority of the people in New York State are women, and are the majority of the women in New York State and in the country are women voters. So women mm-hmm. have a chance to seize this opportunity to stand up. That women should be believing in themselves and running for office and taking this opportunity to really change the course of what's going on here in this country right now. And I think women do bring something different to the table. As far as women judges, it's not just that you're a woman. You have to be a good person. You have to be a qualified candidate and be a woman,
right.
You know, and do a good job. I'm a mother of four, so I am a caretaker. I am a great multitasker, so I've been juggling my kids and several jobs
right.
over the years. I actually worked my way through law school as a single mom, so I've met a lot of challenges as a woman and that other women can relate to. And I'm very compassionate. And when I have people in my courtroom, as a mom, as a woman, as a person, I treat each person that comes before me with respect, you know, the same respect that I would treat my own self or my own children or my own
mm-hmm.
family. And I really seek to help people make progress whenever possible when they come into my courtroom.
Well, that's what's so interesting, too. You know, most men are not single fathers and don't have four children to raise, and also still go to law school and pass the exam and then eventually rise up to the point of being a judge in Peekskill, and now you're going even higher. Where did all this come from, this interest? Well, certainly the responsibility of having the children, then that becomes a given once you have them, of course. But where does the political and involvement and the involvement with the courts and with the legal system come from? Because I think you have a father that is a good leader, a good role model, as they say.
Absolutely, and I was just going to say that it really started with my upbringing. I have a father who is involved, has always been involved in politics, and I grew up
right.
as a child of Yonkers, campaigning, pounding the streets of Yonkers and handing out palm cards and campaigning for my dad and other candidates. He was a two-term councilman in Yonkers and then the mayor. So I've
right.
been a way of life for me since I was a toddler. I've been doing this and I've been committed to the Democratic Party and its values. Yeah, really. I mean, it's like since I was in diapers, I've been in campaign headquarters. And so my father, you know, he's a person of great integrity, and he instilled in his children the need to give back to the community, to figure out who you are and what you can give and give that back to the community and to the world. And also my mother is a teacher. And she always worked with special needs kids, and she also believed the same thing. So I had two parents that were instilling this in me. And then I went out into the world. I my parents taught me that racism is bad, you know, we had a lot of family conversations about that growing up as Democrats over the years. And then I went out into the world, and I learned more about it. So when I was in college, I went to South Africa, and I actually stood up against apartheid in South Africa when I was there, and I learned a lot about social mm-hmm. justice from that experience, and I brought that perspective with me back to this country. So when you go to another country, it sort of opens up your eyes and gives you a new perspective, so when you come back to where you're from, you can see even more clearly the things that are wrong. So I think that
because it's
when
not
I came back
rule.
Here,
it's not a-
It's
yeah,
not as
it's
raw.
Not
yeah,
as
so you step out of it. Right. You step out and
yeah.
you come back into it. And so when I came back
so
here
when you went
and
to
I
South Africa, sorry.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm just so excited that I met somebody on the air that actually went to South Africa. So did I. And I found the experience totally exhilarating. I was in Cape Town all the way to Oudtshoort, where they had the ostriches and Durban and was it the I forgot now. There was a big game reserve that is public along the Mozambique border, and Soweto and Johannesburg. How did that inform you? Because how were you able to capture what was there and the apartheid that was there and bring it here?
So when I went there, I had a professor who was from there originally. So he introduced me to the politics of the place. And I felt like I was in a time warp of sorts, because there people were very politically active. It felt like you were in the 70s, I would think. So people were very politically active. Everybody was talking about politics all the time. Soon after I got there, there was a march downtown, and there were the police dogs rounding people up like cattle. And people smiling and toy-toying. I don't know if you experienced the toy-toy when you were there. And people just protesting. And the thing about South Africa at the time was that the African people were outnumbering the white people 10 to 1, you know, and they were still under the system of legislated racism. It was just a sight to see. And then, you know, I talked to people from all walks of life when I was there. I talked to somebody that was in the military that explained to me how they trained the dogs. They would have an African man put a glove on, a metal glove, and they would train the dogs to only attack African people. So, you know, I traveled around. I was a musician there playing music. So I went to all the corners of South Africa playing music and spreading a message of unity when I was there. And it was just a tragically beautiful place. I mean, the most beautiful place I've ever seen. And the tragedy being that it was still under legislated racism. And now it's not, thank God, but the struggle really continues.
The struggles do continue.
Yeah. So, you know, and then coming back here after that experience really, really just strengthened my sense of social justice and purpose. And so when I tried to decide what I would do next, I assessed my values and I said, hey, you know, I'll make a great lawyer. I'll go do some civil rights work and such. And that was my thinking at the time, or perhaps even environmental work. And then when I did the PACE Criminal Defense Law Clinic, and I knew as soon as I stepped into the courtroom, I knew that was my calling. That's what I needed to do. And then I just pursued that as a career. I was lucky enough to get a job here at the Legal Aid Society as a public defender.
Personally, I'm not certain what restorative justice is, but was that something that was informed to you when you visited South Africa? Was that one of the residual effects that you engage in the courtroom when you make decisions?
Yes, I believe that. I mean, basically, what it means is that the accused and the victims be made whole. So that somehow, throughout the process, there's acceptance, some sort of forgiveness, penalty. There's something that's going to put everybody in a better place after this terrible experience. So that's basically what it means. And you know, in my courtroom, I treat people on a case by case basis. And as a public defender, I've come to know that the multitude of issues that arise and that can be seen when you see somebody that gets mired and caught into the criminal justice system. So there are so many issues that people could have that need to be addressed. And, you know, there are mental health treatment issues, there are drug treatment issues, there are services that need to be provided. So, you know, there's education, there's job training, there's so many things that are out there for people to, once they're, you know, they come into the court system, they can leave better. You know, we could do something to help people become better, and therefore the society and the community is better off in the end. And we could spend our money doing those sorts of things.
So it seems that the legal system is still somehow deprived giving people accused of one thing or another better facilities to be able to avoid getting to that point. Is that what's missing too? We don't have legal aid lawyers. You were evidently one as you were going through the schooling process. So did that inform you as well, some of the questions that needed to be asked of people who would come before a courtroom?
Right, and also as a legal aid lawyer, I would be personally in touch with the person that was accused of the crime, and
right.
Then part of my job would be to try to ascertain what that is, and to have social workers and counselors
okay.
Meet with that person to see what it is and how we can help there. So yes, that definitely informs
mm-hmm.
My decision making, and I've learned that people are individuals.
Yeah. One thing that was interesting as well, I understand that you have an interest in fighting for an underground railroad site in Peekskill. There is such a history and legacy in the city of Yonkers as well. Was that something also that you grew up with, that concept that may not have been expected to be undertaken maybe 20 or 30 years ago, but certainly it's important now. I don't even know, though, if we've gotten as far as your intention is for Peekskill to commemorate that history in Yonkers. I don't think that's been done yet. But you're moving ahead in Peekskill. How is that working out?
Well, this is something that I had worked on when I was in law school. So we have there's Fern.
Okay.
Fern Joseph in Peekskill has been working on this for years, and she has been committed
uh-huh.
to it, and she still to this day gives the tours there. And so I worked on
nice.
It when I met her years ago, and she's amazing. She had a lot of the information. She had oral history, tape recordings of oral history of people saying what had happened as far as Underground Railroad going through Peekskill. And by the way, it makes sense that it's going through Yonkers and Yonkers as well, because the Underground Railroad it was usually attached to a railroad. So people would take the train up,
correct.
And then they would make their way up to safe houses and doctors' offices and other places along the way. So the importance of the Underground Railroad history and tradition and story being put out is that it's such a beautiful civil rights struggle, a struggle for freedom, that Harriet Tubman and others took people on this journey to freedom, the enslaved people on a journey to freedom up north, and along the way, all colors of people assisted. So in Peekskill, you had Henry Ward Beecher, who was an abolitionist, who they made their way up to,
mm-hmm.
who would help people on the way. So it's just such a beautiful civil rights struggle and story, and it really is a tribute to our country that this even happened, and it's really important for people to see it and feel it and know the story and the history. And that's why it was so important to me.
Well, evidently, and it makes sense, but as a society, we're not living what our history told us we should move from towards something else. And is it conceivable even that in ruling for example, as a sitting as a judge in Westchester County Court, can one move the legal process toward greater accommodation of people who've been maligned in the past and others that may have done very well because of the bias and the bigotry? Can we balance society in a better way, or is that, something that we can never get to? Bias
I think we
is
can
just
get there.
That.
Yeah, you know what? I am an optimistic person, and that's why I
uh-huh.
work towards progress.
Right.
So I think we can do it. I think we just need to focus our money and our efforts on things that will improve society. So better education,
mm-hmm.
Better programs for people. Right now, there's a deficit of mental health treatment programs for people. We need more of that. So I think we can do it. We just need to be smart about how we're spending our money and resources. And I'm, like I said, I'm very optimistic that things can improve. Things are always getting better. So
mm-hmm.
I'm progressive and I mean it. So, yeah.
Well, one thing in order of comparison, here you are now in the Peekskill Court, and you're vying to become the next Westchester County Court judge. And what is the difference in demeanor of one court as opposed to the county court? Is there a difference? Are there different cases that are brought before a county, the county court as opposed to the city court?
Yes. So this, in the city court, we, you know, I'm already a judge there, and so I have a criminal calendar there. And so in the city court, we actually arraign the felonies and the misdemeanors, and all the criminal cases, all the arrests that come through. But cases that are will remain as felonies that aren't reduced will go to the county court. So that would just be the next step for me. So it's kind of like a learning process, and I've already learned the first part. I've already been there. And also, I've already, as a city court judge, I'm the only candidate who has already trained for this job. So I've already been sent, OCA has already sent me to the Judicial Training Institute. I've had weeks and weeks of training over the past several years. I've trained with, I've already trained with the county court judges. They have a great institute where they train the judges on the law and all the important issues. And I've trained with the Supreme Court judges as well. So I'm the only one actually that has all the training already. So I'm ready to do the job, hit the ground running, and, you know, do it to the best of my abilities. And I feel that I'm highly qualified and uniquely qualified coming from, you know, a public defender, pro-choice, progressive woman background.
Right. And why is the progressive demeanor in the court system so important? Do people even recognize the importance of it, or do they just poo-poo it and make believe that it's really not pertinent? How does the law create a progressive agenda through the courtroom, or can it?
Well, I think it's important for the purposes of equal justice for everybody to consider everybody as an individual person, regardless of gender, race, And so that's an important part of it. And I think I think the progressive values are more leaning more towards, you know, making progress for people. So try to some people deserve to be punished for serious crimes, but the prison system can be improved to make those people better before they're released back into our society, right? So So better programs, better preparation to re-enter into the society, and it's a win-win for the person that's eventually re-entering to society and the society itself. So we can spend our money better.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. As the judge, is it possible to direct remediation of a particular individual that comes before you for whatever the case is, so that they can get the assistance through the support mechanisms that exist in our society, and possibly even promote others to better embellish it, so whether it be for mental health issues or other infractions of the law? How does one do that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, a judge can direct someone to seek mental health treatment or drug treatment, or even make any conditions whatsoever on somebody and say, hey, why don't you, you know, and I've practiced this in my courtroom as well, and hypothetically could say, you know, instead of going to jail for 30 days, which is what the offer is, and maybe the person thinks that's a good idea, how about instead of that, you go out and you find a drug treatment program, bring me proof of that, and we're going to help you along, and we're going to monitor that instead of the jail time that's going to do you absolutely no good. Or get a job and come back and show me proof of that. Do something for yourself, and I'll help you along with that, and don't give up on yourself, because I believe in you, right? Because some people feel like nobody believes in them, and they just give up, and I don't want people to give up on themselves.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that up, because I don't think that men are callous to all these things, but I wonder if men tend to take the time, which I think is more of the nurturing attitude of a woman. So I think that when a woman tells you to give yourself an opportunity and to encourage you, it there's a different sense of encouragement that is probably also more acceptable. You know, for a man or even a woman to accept, especially when it comes from, someone like you with your credentials, and you're giving them an opportunity. Do you find that this sort of attitude and this sort of option that you give to people who come before your court, does that tend to work?
Does it work? I find that it does work happily, and I'm so happy when it does work, because it's so important for people to for somebody to believe in somebody and to give them the chance to
right.
do that. And it could be a female sort of thing. I mean, there's great compassionate men out there as well.
Oh, absolutely.
But for myself, I am a mother, so I guess some of that does translate into people when they're before me.
Uh huh.
As far as my compassion and my motherliness.
Yeah, well, I hope it doesn't sound like I'm demeaning men. I think I'm a very compassionate guy. And
right.
But at the same time, I think there's something that is essentially unrecognized by a lot of men with respect to women, and that even women have actually dampened that empathic capacity that they have because it's been frowned upon in the past. But I think women are discovering who they are now better than ever before. And is that
right.
also changing the demeanor of the courts?
For myself, yes. I mean, I think women are, they're doing great. And
mm-hmm.
as far as me being a woman and running, I find that I'm campaigning every day. And so I'm meeting women that are saying, you know, hey,
right.
I'm going for you. And I've even met women saying that, I meet women campaigning, they say, and I try to give them a palm card, and they say, I already have your palm card on my refrigerator. so it's really nice. It's really beautiful. I'm so touched by that. And it comes full circle because, you know, I believe in people. So it's nice to go out to have people come back and say that they believe in me as well. It's a beautiful
mm-hmm.
thing. I mean, I've even had men tell me, men attorneys say, look, I'd like women judges better. I want, you know, I'm going for you. You're
mm-hmm.
a great candidate. I appreciate your background and your experience. I know you're a woman, you're pro-choice, you're progressive. And so they say, I've had men say the same thing. Look, I'm going for you because I like women. I like to appear before women judges better. So
mm-hmm.
that's another aspect of it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good thing. So I must be in touch with my feminine side because I take palm cards and I stick it on my refrigerator door.
Oh, nice.
So I don't know what that says about me, but
I
I'm
hope
there.
You have mine up
so
there.
I do, actually.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Well,
great.
So that's the story. Well, unfortunately, we've come very close to the end. Is there, like, something that we haven't discussed? You've been so eloquent and you've been so tolerant of my questions. What needs more to be told?
The only thing left, and it's been a delight and a pleasure to speak with you. The only thing left is there's a primary on June 25th, and everybody needs to get out
right.
there and vote. There are four people going for two open spots. I'm the only woman mm-hmm. running. I got the lucky first pick on the ballot. The first person that you'll see when you look at the ballot, no matter where you're voting, the county
mm-hmm.
run is first. So it's easy to remember. Again, I'm the only woman out of the four, and progressive, fully qualified, and ready to hit the ground running for this county on day one.
So, and your name is Melissa.
Melissa
Lohr. L-O-E-H-R. Lohr,
right.
Is that how you pronounce it? Oh,
right.
I pronounce it more from a Germanic perspective. That's my problem. I speak German, so.
Right. How do you pronounce it?
I pronounce it Lohr. Like
okay.
O with they in America it's called Matilda. It's two dots over the O. In German
right.
it's umlaut. So
right.
and then when they wanted to anglicize it a little bit better, they made it O E, which is supposed
mm-hmm.
to do that that same sound. But I defer to you because we're in America. So
well,
I
like the way you pronounce it. Yeah, I love the way you pronounce it. People ask me, and then people are still confused by the spelling, the O and the E, and they ask how do you pronounce it. And
right.
I just say Lohr rhymes with door. And in
yeah,
this case,
absolutely.
You open up the door to democracy and vote for me on June 25th.
Before you go,
so,
is there like a website that people can go to learn more about you? Do you still do people come out and engage in promoting a candidate for the courts, or is it different when you run for a judgeship as opposed to a candidate for political office?
You know, it is harder because as a judicial candidate, I'm not allowed to come out and tell what my positions are on everything. We have
right.
rules that we have to abide by.
We
but we have
transgress
a.
That today,
I can tell. Excuse me.
I said I don't think we transgressed that today, did we?
No, I'm very careful.
No, I was,
not to do that.
Because
so,
I don't have a gun, but I would get one and blow my brains out at this point.
No, no. Okay, so it's electjudgelore.com. So it's electjudge,
okay.
LOEHR.com is my website where people can volunteer,
okay.
Donate, contact us, let us know if you're available to join the campaign. We'd love to have you. And then I have
mm-hmm.
a Facebook page, Judge Melissa Lore for County Court. This is the Facebook. And then we have Instagram and Twitter, at Elect Judge Lore. So we have all these things. And we appreciate everybody's support. And, yeah, and that's about it. We're out there campaigning every
Fantastic.
Day. Looking forward to winning it. And I can only do that with everybody's vote. So the important thing is that people vote. Some people might not have a primary in their local town or city, so it would be the only thing they're coming out to vote for. Please do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's your right, and people should support this. They should support voting in primaries generally because it's more of a democratic process. And I appreciate everybody. And it's so beautiful meeting people on the campaign trail out in public. People are really wonderful to engage with. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of fun. Well, thank you for making the time. I hope we'll have an opportunity to do this again. There'll be other things to discuss. A half hour is pretty much a truncated moment, but
right.
it's valid. Thank
yeah.
you so much. All the best.
Thank you, Hezzy. Have a great day. Thanks so much. All right.
My pleasure. Judge
okay.
Melissa Lure, she's running for, thank you, Judge Melissa Lure, L-O-E-H-R, or Lure, L-O-E-H-R. She's running for Westchester County Court Judge. The primary is this June 25, and that's going to make it or break it for whoever gets designated in the election process is your next judge on the county court. Very
yeah,
interesting.
Let's get,
and just in case there's some – yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
And one more thing. We just celebrated the
sure.
Women's 100th year of having a right to vote. So we need to get out there and exercise
I didn't realize
that right.
That.
Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
A couple days ago. So it's 100th year right to vote. Women need to get out there and exercise that, and everybody needs to get out, exercise your right to vote. People have fought and died for it.
Well, you heard it here first. She's the judge. You might as well follow through.
I'm ordering you.
Okay.
Great.
I hear you.
Okay.
Because I don't want to come back before your courtroom in 30 days, and you'll be disappointed in me. So I'm going to just do as you say.
That's right. I have faith
well,
in you,
thanks very much.
Thank you. All right, take care.
Thank you so much.
All
Be
right.
well.
Okay, thanks
Bye.
A lot. You too. Bye-bye.
Well, there we have it, folks. So the judge is online, and evidently there was a caller that called in for our office number, so we'll have to call them back afterwards because our show continues. And we'll be on for another hour. I didn't want to interrupt the time schedule for the judge because she was constrained from the time that she came on at 10:30 to 11 o'clock, and then she's got to go to her courtroom. I think she's got a hearing as well at this moment. So we won't be able to call up to, with regard to speak to that caller now. They're listening in. So I want you to go over to some other issues as well. One thing that came up in the United States today is that the U.S. trade deficit falls at 2.1% in April, even as exports dive. So that's the report. It seems that the mammoth U.S. trade deficit shrank in April, even as exports saw the biggest dive in more than 4 years. That's what the Commerce Department reported today, which points to weakening momentum in the U.S. economy. Nevertheless, the narrowing trade gap could cheer President Donald Trump, who has made a cutting America's trade imbalance a priority. But the deficit in goods trade with China expanded in the latest month despite the steep tariffs the president has imposed. So the falling deficit comes as economists warn that rising barriers to international commerce threaten to derail the global economy. So far this year, the U.S. trade gap is still 2% higher than the same period in 2018. So the U.S. trade deficit fell 2.1% in April,
to $50.8 billion seasonally adjusted, largely in line with analysts' expectations. But the figure was only a decrease after a sharp upward revision to the March data. So exports declined by $4.6 billion to $206.8 billion, the largest drop since January of 2015. But imports fell faster, dropping $5.7 billion, the largest dip in 3 months. So the trade deficit with China jumped 7.6% for the month, but was still down 10.8% for the year amid the escalation of a year-long trade war. So meanwhile, the deficit with Mexico fell 0.6% to $7.9 billion for the month, helping reverse part of this year's sharp increase. And President Trump has threatened steep tariffs on all Mexican goods as he demands help stemming the flow of migrants from Central America. The export slump was broad-based. Autos and parts, medicines, and a $2.3 billion drop in civilian aircraft, likely reflecting the suspension of deliveries for a top-selling Boeing jet grounded after two deadly crashes. And now we hear that the planes from Boeing, it may take another few months before it gets resolved. Exports of capital goods were at their lowest since October of 2017, while travel services as well as maintenance and repair also dipped. So meanwhile, the American demand for capital goods like civilian aircraft engines and microchips fell to their lowest level in 16 months. The United States also imported fewer autos and auto parts, organic chemicals and gemstones, and bought less natural gas and wood pulp. So falling imports in the first quarter helped lift U.S. gross domestic product, but economists caution that it points to a slowdown in underlying economic activity. So we'll have to see if they're right. Still, April's shrinking gap between exports and imports could support growth in the second quarter, which is something that it needs to be recognized, so we'll see where things go. Now, today is June 6th, 2019, but on June 6th of 1944, more than 150,000 Allied troops invaded the northern French coast, marking the start of France's liberation from its Nazi occupiers. It is remembered as a defining moment of World War II, and here are some little-known facts about the longest day. Well, when the Germans came, we told the men to hide. But when the Americans came, we had to hide the women. That's the French joke, which refers to the erotic adventure which the U.S. military promised American soldiers fighting in France. Historian Mary Louise Roberts writes in What Soldiers Do, Sex and the American GI in World War II France. Well, propaganda painted France as a tremendous brothel inhabited by 40 million hedonists. Well, the readers of the militant newspaper, the military newspaper Stars and Stripes could learn the French for "You are very pretty, I am not married, and are your parents at home?" Whereas the German vocabulary section offered phrases such as "No cigarettes" and "Line up," and and Roberts explained. So American promiscuity sparked outrage in cities like Le Havre and Rennes, where sexual acts, quote, took place in parks, cemeteries, streets, and abandoned buildings. More than 150 American soldiers were tried for rape, most of them black, underlining the racial discrimination at the time, Roberts said. With D-Day looming, the Allies prepared for the worst. Supreme Commander of Allied Forces in Europe and future U.S. President Dwight D. Eisenhower prepared himself in advance for announcing a failure. He penned a statement on June 5 entitled, "In Case of Failure," quote unquote, which said that, quote, "any blame or fault is mine alone," end quote. Continuing, he said, "My decision to attack at this time and place was based upon the best information available. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do." Now, Allied forces quickly gained control of 5 points along a 50-mile front on beaches codenamed Utah, Gold, Juno, and Sword. But at Omaha, heavy casualties earned the beach the somber nickname Bloody Omaha. high cliffs there gave the Germans an immediate advantage. Americans were left waist-deep in rough seas as crashing water sank their landing craft, and some drowned. Of the 34,000 Americans deployed, 2,500 were killed or wounded. Some paratroopers drowned in catastrophic jumps, said French historian Jean Guillain, author of The Battle of Normandy. And heavy equipment weighing 65 to 90 pounds pulled them underwater. Fake news might be considered a modern phenomenon, but the British led a deception campaign, codename Operation Fortitude, to try and fool the Germans into thinking the Allies planned to attack Scandinavia and then France's Calais region rather than Normandy. Inflatable tanks were positioned on the British coast facing Calais, and metallic lures were used to make it appear to German radar that a large force was about to land near Calais. Fake radio messages were leaked to German intelligence services. Even after the D-Day landings on June 6, the Germans believed a second attack was planned in the Calais region. Hitler eventually ordered troops to join the Normandy front. Communicating through coded messages would have taken too long during the landings, and commanders couldn't speak in English in case they were intercepted by the Germans. Instead, the Americans used Native American code talkers, especially the Comanche, who worked in their indigenous language. John Parker, son of code talker Simmons Parker, remembers that bomber plane was translated as pregnant bird. He said his father told him that in the Comanche language, crazy white man meant Hitler. In December of 2018, the British Postal Service Royal Mail apologized after releasing a stamp commemorating D-Day's 75th anniversary, showing American troops landing in Indonesia, then known as Dutch New Guinea. "We would like to offer our sincere apologies," the Royal Mail had said. Unbelievable. It's just amazing, and it's so good to be aware of this legacy. Well, something else happened locally. Victims and the gunman have been named in the Virginia Beach mass shooting. So the gunman who killed 12 people at Virginia Beach Municipal Building before dying in a gun battle with police was identified on Saturday as a disgruntled city engineer and co-worker of most of the victims. The mass shooting in the coastal resort of Virginia Beach was the deadliest instance of U.S. gun violence since November of 2018, when a dozen people were slain at a Los Angeles area bar and grill by a gunman who then killed himself. Paying tribute to the victims, Virginia Beach City Manager Dave Hansen said the 12 fatalities, 11 local authority workers, and one contractor, quote, "leave a void we will never be able to fill," end quote. And local police chief James Cervera identified the suspect as Dwayne Craddock, C-R-A-D-D-O-C-K, telling a news conference on Saturday that he would only release his name once. "Then he will be forever referred to as the suspect because our focus now is on the dignity and respect of the victims and their families." Well, Craddock had been employed by the city for 15 years as an engineer and was still employed at the time of the shooting. Cervera said the suspect was armed with a .45 caliber pistol equipped with a sound suppressor device and extended ammunition magazines he used to reload repeatedly during the attack. Survivors recounted scenes of pandemonium and fear that erupted as gunshots rang out and workers scurried frantically for cover. "We just heard people yelling and screaming to get down," Megan Banton, a public utilities worker, told television station WAVY-TV, recalling that she and co-workers barricaded themselves in their office. Quote, "We put the desk up against the door because we didn't know if they were coming in. We were just hoping that it would be over soon, and then we heard the cops yelling up the steps," end quote. The first victim was shot in a vehicle outside the Public Works and Utilities building at the City Municipal Center before the suspect entered that building and, quote, immediately and indiscriminately fired upon all the victims, end quote, Cervera had said. The chief said that the suspect engaged in a, quote, long-term gun battle, end quote, with four police officers who confronted him inside, preventing the gunman from, quote, committing more carnage in the building, end quote. One officer was wounded in the shootout, but his bulletproof vest saved his life, Cervera said. Authorities said that the gunman ultimately was shot by police and was declared dead at a hospital. Cervera said the suspect was a longtime Public Utilities employee and described him as, quote, disgruntled, end quote, but declined to say more about what may have precipitated the attack. Quote, we have more questions than we really have answers, end quote, he told reporters hours after the shooting. The shooting was believed to be the deadliest act of workplace gun violence in the United States in February, when a factory worker shot five colleagues to death in Aurora, Illinois, just after he was let go from his job. So the bloodshed unfolded, according to police, at building two of the municipal center complex, where office space for more than 400 employees houses information technology, public works, planning and utilities departments next door to City Hall. The complex lies several miles inland from the town's popular seashore, situated on the Atlantic coast at the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, and Southeast Virginia's most populous city has roughly 450,000 year-round residents. This is the most devastating day in the history of Virginia Beach, Mayor Bobby Dyer said at a news conference with a police chief. The people involved are our friends, co-workers, neighbors, colleagues, end quote. Arriving in town a short time after the shooting, Virginia Governor Ralph Northam said, this is just a horrific day. Our hearts ache for victims of the senseless violence that has been inflicted on the community, he told the news conference. In Washington, a White House spokesman said President Donald Trump had been briefed on the shooting and, quote, continues to monitor the situation, end quote. Well, according to the Washington-based Gun Violence Archive Monitoring Group, Friday's shooting was the 150th mass shooting in the United States this year, defined as a single event in which four or more people are shot or killed. Despite the scale of gun violence across the nation, gun ownership laws are lax, and efforts to address the issue legislatively have long been deadlocked at the federal level. Among Democrats, the response to the shooting was especially pointed, with many of the party's White House hopefuls weighing in on the gun violence crisis. Another horrific shooting shocks the nation, this time in Virginia Beach, said Pete Buttigieg in a tweet, quote, already this much is clear. It is unacceptable for America to remain the only developed country where this is routine. We must act, end quote, he said. That's while Bernie Sanders decried the influence of the National Rifle Association, a powerful lobby group that routinely calls for more guns in the United States society so that ordinary citizens are armed and ready to confront a bad guy, quote unquote. Now, Congress, he said, must listen to the American people and pass gun safety legislation. This sickening gun violence must stop, he said in a tweet. So that's the perspective of Bernie Sanders. Now, this is interesting because I didn't expect this to happen, but it did. Syrian Kurds have repatriated eight people from the Islamic group from Islamic group families to the United States. So two American women and six children from families of suspected Islamic State group members were repatriated to the United States yesterday in the latest transfers from a crowded camp in Syria. The move is part of an effort by the Kurdish administration in northeast Syria to reduce the population of Al-Hol, which is crammed with nearly 74,000 people from more than 40 countries. It comes after Norway, on Monday, retrieved five Norwegian orphans from the same camp, and Kurdish authorities started sending hundreds of Syrian women and children home as part of a wider effort to clear Al-Hol of its Syrian inhabitants. Uzbekistan said it repatriated more than 100 nationals from Syria last week. Wednesday's repatriation was carried out, quote, at the request of the United States government and based on the free and voluntary desire of the American citizen to return to their country without any pressure or coercion. That's what a spokesman by the name of Kamal Akif said in a statement. Akif told Agence France-Presse that eight people were from, quote, Islamic State, which is IS, or the Islamic State Group, families staying at Al Hud, which is populated by suspected Islamic State Group members, their families, as well as regular civilians forced out of their homes by successive U.S.-backed assaults against the last bastions of the jihadists' caliphate. So in Washington, a State Department spokeswoman confirmed that the United States had safely recovered, quote unquote, citizens, including young children from Syria, and was assisting in their repatriation. She did decline to identify them due to privacy considerations. Well, the Turkish administration is, the Kurdish administration is looking to take off its hands thousands of foreign jihadists and their relatives trapped in Kurdish held camps and detention centers following the declared defeat of the Islamic State group Proto State on March 23rd. But repatriation is a sensitive issue for Western nations such as France and Britain, which have experienced attacks by homegrown extremists and have little interest in seeing more return. Britain has gone so far as to strip Islamic State group members of citizenship, while France has said it will repatriate only orphans. The United States, however, has urged Western countries to take their nationals back and has started repatriating some of its own. Prior to Wednesday, the United States had taken home three Islamic State fighters for prosecution and also repatriated one woman with her four children, according to the State Department. And the State Department spokeswoman said that the United States was aware of more purported U.S. citizens in Syria, but that the cases were, quote, extremely complicated, end quote, due to conditions on the ground and the lack of U.S. consular access, quote. We take seriously all legitimate claims of U.S. citizenship, no matter where those claims are made, and work to verify and handle those claims on a case-by-case basis, she said. The United States balked in the most high-profile case, Hoda Mutana, a young woman from Alabama who joined the Islamic State group. The United States in February said that Mutana was not a citizen due to her father's former diplomatic status. The U.S. Constitution grants citizenship to everyone born in the country with the exception of children of diplomats, as they are not under the jurisdiction of the United States. Mutana's father, Ahmed Ali, served at the Yemeni mission at the United Nations. He has filed a lawsuit seeking to affirm his daughter's citizenship, saying he had left his diplomatic post several months before her birth. Well, the Kurdish administration aid agencies have warned of deteriorating humanitarian conditions in Al-Hol, where acute malnutrition, pneumonia, and dehydration are rife among children in the camp. The situation in the camp is very difficult. Sheikh Musa Ahmed, an official with the Kurdish administration, told Agence France-Presse earlier this week. He accused the international community of, quote, neglecting the responsibilities towards the displaced in Al-Hol, most of whom were evacuated from the caliphate. Some evacuees from Islamic State group areas have been repentant, but others have made clear their allegiance to the Islamic State group remains intact, turning Al-Hol into a tinderbox. Residents have reported clashes with guards, violent factional quarrels, warning that Al-Hol is emerging as a fresh jihadist powder keg. In recent weeks, women in the camp have staged demonstrations demanding better services as well as information on their husbands held by the Kurds, according to the United Nations Humanitarian Office. So, compelling news. Let me quickly look at our studio screen. Bear with me a moment. Okay, so everything seems to be fine at this point, and wanted to go over to some other things here. Bear with me a second. Okay, now this is really quite compelling. Evidently, Fiat has pulled out of the Renault merger deal, blaming the French government. So this is a major, major disaster, I think, for so many of these automobile companies combined. seems that Fiat Chrysler said to yesterday it was withdrawing its $35 billion merger offer for Renault, blaming French politics for scuttling what would have been a landmark deal to create the world's third biggest automaker. A source close to the French carmaker's board said Fiat Chrysler made the move after France sought to delay a decision on the deal in order to win the support of Nissan Motor Company, Renault's Japanese alliance partner. Now, French government officials had pushed for Nissan to support the merger. Nissan had said it would abstain. The French government, which owns a 15% stake in Renault, had also pushed Fiat Chrysler and Renault for guarantees that France would not lose jobs and for a dividend to be paid to Renault shareholders, including government people familiar with the talks, it said. Quote, it has become clear that the political conditions in France do not currently exist for such a combination to proceed successfully, Fiat Chrysler said in a statement. Renault, in a separate statement, said its board was, quote, unable to make a decision due to the request expressed by the representatives of the French state to postpone the vote to a later meeting, end quote. French Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire defended the government's role in the negotiations, dismissing Fiat Chrysler's assertion that politics were to blame. Quote, an agreement had been reached on three of the four conditions. What remained to be obtained was the explicit support of Nissan, Le Maire had said. The apparent collapse of merger talks leave the two companies facing an array of issues, starting with the likely dismay of investors who bid up shares in both companies after Fiat Chrysler proposed a merger of equals just over a week ago. Fiat Chrysler had proposed that its shareholders receive a 2.5 billion euro, that's $2.8 billion special dividend as part of the merger had it been completed. Two companies told investors a merger would cut running costs by 5 billion euros, that's $5.6 billion or more a year. Fiat Chrysler stood to gain access to Renault's superior electric drive technology to meet mandates for zero-emission cars. Renault would have had a share of the Italian-American company's lucrative Jeep sport utility vehicle and Ram, the pickup truck franchises. It is not clear what the two companies will do next to tackle the cost of far-reaching technological and regulatory changes. Fiat Chrysler had held inconclusive talks with France's PSA group, which is Peugeot, which also has the French government as a shareholder. So PSA Group is Peugeot and Citroën. Now, Renault's previous alliance and cross-shareholding with Japanese automaker Nissan had loomed all along as a potential snag. Nissan chief executive Hiroto Saikawa met last week with Renault chief executive Jean-Dominique Senard and said he did not see, quote, any particular negative aspect, end quote, to the proposed Renault-Fiat Chrysler merger, but people familiar with the situation said Nissan executives were blindsided by the merger proposal. A Nissan spokesman had no immediate comment. So, very compelling to say the least. But this is a major, major deal. We'll see if it ever comes back into some form of negotiation. We'll have to see where that goes. So, very, very encouraging that it might happen, but discouraging at the moment. So we'll just have to see what gives. One split second. All right, let me just quickly look at some other issues, should there be any, and make sure that we cover them before we depart the scene. I wanted to check about this. Bear with me a moment. No. I thought that I had this in place, but evidently not. One more second. No, I think that we've covered as much as we can today. Tomorrow is another day, and tomorrow is Friday. We're going to be speaking to Victoria Garrity, the mayor of Ossining. We're going to speak to Commissioner Clyde. I'm losing my mind. 1 second. Clyde Isley, that's what it is. Too many names coming into my mind. But Clyde Isley, the former commissioner in Mount Vernon, will speak to him from Victoria Gary, the mayor, from 10 to 10:30. The commissioner, Clyde Isley, is running for mayor in the city of Mount Vernon from 10:30 to 11. And we'll speak to Rich Cerulli at 11 o'clock. So that's the story there. Okay, so that that is where we are. And we'll speak to you tomorrow. So thank you for being with us today. What a pleasure. And thank you to all our guests. They have been stupendous. I got to thank Judge Melissa Lur, of course, the driving me duo, crazy duo, John and Lori Wiles, and of course you. Very, very encouraging day today. So I hope we've done you proud, as you've done us proud. Thank you so much. Let me just forget this. Bear with me a moment, and we'll end this particular.